Hello, and welcome to the Debt Wired podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Saba, senior reporter of Debt Wire North America. I'm glad to be joined today by Holly Etlin, turnaround specialist at Alex Partners, a restructuring advisory firm that has been among the top ranked in terms of the number of North American mandates for some of the largest retail special situations. When she is not sandbiking with restructuring colleagues and friends on Fire Island in the summer, or skiing in Park City, Utah in the winter, she is providing financial advisory solutions to retail companies and their lenders. So Holly, with a 30-year track record of acting as a doctor to unwell retail companies, what do you think it takes to have a lasting career in restructuring?
First of all, you have to realize that opting into a career in restructuring means that you're going to give up a lot of personal time. You know, crisis situations, I have board meetings at 7 p.m. on a Saturday night or 9 p.m. on a weeknight. The management team only has time to focus on big transformational issues on Saturday or Sunday morning. So it is a very intense career. And then you've really got to find something that floats your boat, that you really love doing. You know, I was lucky in that I truly, genuinely love retail. If I hadn't done a restructuring career, I would have been in management and retail somewhere. And this allows me to sort of combine both, which is the crisis piece along with the fundamental fix-it piece.
Got it. So did you always know you wanted to help companies as far back as college? I heard at one point you may have been a pre-med student.
I was a pre-med student. And at the end of my sophomore year at UCLA, I threw in the towel. I didn't want to focus everything I did at college on getting into med school. In those days, everything that everybody did, if they volunteered, if they worked, if they did anything, it had to be accretive to their resume when they applied to medical school. And I didn't want to be that narrow in college. I was attending a major university. I was a member of a sorority. I wanted to do fun stuff. I swapped over to economics in my junior year, and luckily all of my science and math courses counted as my breath requirements in the new major. So all I had to do was focus on taking a couple years worth of courses in the major.
Great. So fast forwarding to now, what is the advice you are giving retail clients concerning the impending rise on imported tariffs?
You know, it changes day to day. Unfortunately, this administration is getting a lot of blowback. And so they're changing their mind or modifying their views on certain things, but not others. They're deferring. So it's hard for a retailer. You're looking at a 4 to 6 month lead time on product. So now you have to place your bet as to when the product arrives from wherever it arrives, it's going to be advantageous to you. A lot of people are negotiating a split of any tariff impact with the vendor, where the vendor takes part of it. They're going to take the other part, and then they'll decide how they price the product when it comes in. But people are also equally concerned about consumer demand in the fourth quarter. Most people are forecasting very modest, if not a drop, in consumer demand through the fall and holiday period as people worry about their economic situation and the economy, et cetera. People are really struggling in the boardroom to figure out what their path ought to be and how to figure out a sales forecast and then buy to the forecast in the most advantageous way.
That's interesting. I mean, where are retailers shifting their sourcing of goods from, in your experience, for those that are heavily reliant on China?
Post-COVID, everybody who could diversified out of China. Vietnam, Indonesia, knitwear in India, Mexico. Anywhere that you could go to have a more diversified supplier base. Now, the problem has been that in certain industries, it isn't that easy. You know, automotive, it takes a couple of years to 4 or 5 years to build a plant and have it certified. Apparel, a little bit easier. But people also who track in highly inexpensive extruded plastic products, office supplies, costume jewelry, stuff like that, didn't diversify because, frankly, it didn't make sense. China was still the lowest cost producer. And for them, when you're selling something at a $20 price point or a $5 price point or a $1 price point, you just couldn't afford to have that kind of disruption in your cost base that moving might entail. But a lot of people did diversify. Unfortunately, some of the current administration's targets are some of the places they went to. It was amazing. A number of people moved their e-commerce operations to Mexico. If their average order was under $800, they could meet the fulfillment expectations of the U.S. customer as far as timing went, because FedEx really had a great program coming out of Mexico and shipping into the United States very quickly. But now that incentive is gone. And what are you going to do with your e-commerce facility in Mexico? So lots of longer term issues that just aren't going to get solved this year.
Wow. According to DebtWire's league table, there appears to be more in-court versus out-of-court retail restructurings for last year. Why do you think these situations more commonly end up in the courtroom?
Probably has the most to do with the lending structure. And then also, if you have a major store closure program that you want to affect, it's usually more efficient and more effective to do it through a bankruptcy because of the protections that you receive for store liquidations and also for rejecting leases. However, the vast majority of those retailers that you see go in because they're out of money and there is no exit available to them. They just go in to liquidate, which is very unfortunate, a direct outgrowth of the bankruptcy law changes that were made in 2005 around assumption and rejection of leases.
What do you think needs to change so we'll see less liquidations in retail?
Well, I'd love to see the law with regard to lease assumptions change, or at least get more balanced. Right now, you know, you've got 210 days to assume or reject a lease. The DIP lenders take a 90-day liquidation period off of that and then tell you you have to have the company sold or confirm a reorganization plan within 120 days. That is light speed in bankruptcy. I mean, we regularly see non-retail businesses hang in there. And the only businesses that go longer than that from a retail perspective are ones where maybe a large portion of the leases have a second non-filed party that's a guarantor or some other reason that the landlords don't want to take the properties back. There has been some softening of that issue in that landlords, you know, now have a lot of vacant space. But at the end of the day, if you've been distressed or if the landlord thinks you're ultimately not going to be viable, they would really rather call the question and have their space back. So you have to kind of even that playing field. Otherwise, you're doing the vast majority of your restructuring discussion and your planning in advance before the company's out of money. And that is a very hard discussion in today's boardroom around, should we be hiring restructuring advisors this early? And what if it leaks to the marketplace? What's that going to do with our vendors? Board members think vendors have no clue. Well, you know, they all talk to each other. There are no secrets.
Yeah.
In retail world, at least, there are no secrets. You have to literally do the vast majority of the turnaround and the planning and all of that negotiation well in advance of filing. And so you're just going in to file to bless the deal that's already been cut.
Got it. I mean, let's talk about out-of-court restructurings, or as they call them now, liability management exercises. It seems like there's not too much happening in retail LMEs. I mean, we saw At Home Group did one 2 years ago, but why is that? And do you think that'll change?
It has to do with the way retail is typically financed. Very, very large retailers do have bond and complex debt structures where you could, if you needed to, effectuate an LME. But if you're a specialty retailer of some sort, you're going to be mainly financed by asset-based facilities, a first lien, a second lien, maybe a third lien facility. And those do not lend themselves as well to LMEs as more bondholder, noteholder structures.
Got it. My last question is, what makes a prearranged bankruptcy successful in that they don't file less than a year after they emerge? What do you think makes it successful? Because I'm seeing more and more prearranged deals, and then they're right back into court 6, 7, 8 months after.
Yeah, Chapter 22s, we call them.
Yes.
The the lenders don't want to take the haircut that's really necessary for the company to survive. People don't want to have to write down the debt on their balance sheet or in their fund, and therefore they don't do it. They don't do what's necessary to leave the company with enough runway to survive and look to an equity position for their recovery.
That makes sense. So we need to see them, lenders, taking more haircuts, right? Would that be
unfortunately, it? Yes. So, or at least not counting on so much cash pay portion, or companies management will be clear and they'll say, as part of the restructuring, we need to come out of this with $250, $300 million of dry capital, because our vendors are not going to give us all of our trade credit back all at once. And we're going to be facing an uphill battle because we're going to have to really make some serious changes to merchandising and win back the customer. And, you know, all the things that a retailer might do if they're kind of resetting their business. But by the time some of these lenders get done, instead of the 250 to 300 that management said they needed, they've gone after you and, well, no, you have to do better with the vendors and you have to do this and you have to do that. So then management is faced with settling on a much smaller number than they needed, really, rather than liquidate the business today. It's kind of kicking the can down the road. And then the inevitable happens, which is the company just does not have enough liquidity coming out to really survive any serious bumps in the road, be they things in the economy or a slower implementation of some change in the business than you planned, or not getting the vendor support that you were forced by your lenders to say you would try to go get, but then your lenders don't ante up with the additional money that you need. So there you go. And you're right back there, and then now you're done.
Yeah. So what do you think is ahead for the rest of 2025 in terms of restructurings? Can there be retail restructurings where companies are actually fixed and move forward and don't come right back for the
There are a couple pending, but I think anything that we see hit bankruptcy court between now and the end of the year is going to be more in the form of a wind down or a quick sale of parts or half or something of the business. What's interesting is to look at 2026 and see, as the effects of the tariffs and whatever happens with the consumer and the economy are felt, how people are reacting to that, and who else who's okay today, not great, but okay, pushes into that place where they really need to reset their balance sheet, they need to get additional capital, et cetera.
Okay. Well, Holly, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thanks for taking the time to share your valuable insights. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of Debt Wired. As always, you can subscribe to or download every episode via Apple and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at debtwired.com.